I'd like to start this morning. This is February 5th of 2018, with a quote from an English astronomer, physicist, mathematician. His name was Arthur Eddington. Arthur Eddington, the physicist and mathematician, who lived between 1882 and 1944, said something like this. He said, "Something unknown in the universe is doing we don't know what." This is a scientist. Something unknown in the universe is doing we know not what. And the year before he died, Bion again gave us this funny definition. I don't know if it's even a definition of fundamental reality. Bion said, "The fundamental reality is infinity, the unknown, the situation for which there is no language, not even that borrowed from the artist or the religious, which gets anywhere near to describing it." That's the ultimate reality. So what are we all doing?
What's his name again?
That's from Bion, B-I-O-N. The first guy is Arthur Eddington, E-D-D-I-E-I-N-G-T-O-N, Eddington, British. So forget about ultimate reality for a minute, if you can. Dreamwork Alpha. What are we to make of such a term? I think Bion originally picked this word alpha because he doesn't want us to know what it is or to try to pin it down. Of course, today we use the term alpha in a much different way. In fact, today alpha has a very bad reputation. It's a very saturated term. We have too much of it today. In fact, we could say that we have too many alpha males violating others, mostly but not only women. We have too much alpha financial greed. And need I say, way too much yellow-haired alpha. So I want to step back from such uses of the word. I want to try instead to desaturate it of all of the current associations we have. Empty the word out. Empty the word alpha. So that it becomes something like that single point in our chapter. A term with no reference at all. Like an empty X. Something unknown. Something unknown. In the universe is doing we don't know what. If Jung talked about symbols of transformation, Bion and Eigen, it seems to me, are trying to say something about the alpha of transformation, or transformational alpha, as a valuable capacity that we have. But of course, we know a little bit about how Bion and Eigen are using the term alpha in these pages. It is connected to dreams and dreaming and dream work. But these are also something we know so little about. Bion uses the terms dream work and alpha and dream work alpha in similar and overlapping, if not always completely interchangeable ways. Dreamwork Alpha takes internal and external impacts so that they can be stored and recalled and worked with. The overall point that Bion makes is similar. Waking life is dependent on dream life. Dreams store these raw impacts and play a role in the work that makes them communicable. Dream work is not something that just happens at night while we sleep. Dream work is continuous. It goes on while we are asleep or awake. Impressions from outside of us and inside us are transformed by this kind of dream work and made available for further work by consciousness. Selection, attention, memory, repression, even unconsciousness, and all manner of revisions, amplifications, extensions. Dream work plays a role in creative activity and digestion of experience from the bottom up. And then there's funny little parenthesis after this quote, which reads, or almost from the bottom up. This guy is just too mischievous for words. Why does he say almost? I'm going to get to that eventually. And if I forget, you can remind me. And it's a little ironic, too, I think, that we are taking up and studying this very different kind of alpha today, when later this afternoon, we have the other, more saturated kind, the archetypal, competitive, male alpha taking center stage. Maybe we should call it the Super Alpha Bowl. At least somebody's giggling. Well, chapter 3 in our book is about damaged bonds, but chapter 3 is about damaged dream work. And Eigen begins by characterizing dreams as a kind of a womb, and dream work as a kind of a womb for our psyche. Dream as womb, and wombs full of dreams. We might think of dreaming as a kind of a gestation. Can we say a wombing? Can we use womb as a verb? The word incubation also comes close, perhaps another way to say it. What can they be, these words that womb and dream evoke? That cocoon ideas and feelings that give birth to the inchoate, the as yet unborn. At such a point, we are led into realms beyond words, deeper realms of imagery and feeling, perhaps, realms that words can only point towards. An ongoing area of experience that is more than feeling, yet not other than feeling, but including other words like sensing, intimation. And sometimes these nighttime occurrences we call dreams are nothing more than a single image or a whisper. Sometimes just a mood remains after we awaken because they disappear. How do dreams do their work? How does something new come out of them? Where does newness come from? How are such creative products born? Who is their author? How is it that sleep and dreams both help give birth to our emotional growth as well as aid growth of capacity for dreaming? Almost like a virtuous circle can be developed if dreaming and dream work is not too damaged. One time when I was with Eigen, he was talking about, no, I shouldn't say that. He was saying, you know, a lot of a lot of models in psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, they're pretty sure they know. They're pretty certain they have the gold. They know. They're certain they know. He says, my specialty is not knowing. And I think that's sort of when I fell in love. So he says the same thing about emotional experience, Eigen. He says, the emotional experience evolves. He says, we don't know what an emotional experience is. But in Cogitations, Bion's book, Bion writes that the core of the dream, of any dream, is an emotional experience. But we don't often know what it is. Dream emotion can be elusive, too. If you live in a dream, with a dream, one day the emotional experience feels one way, another day it changes somewhat. How do you step into the same dream twice? The emotional experience can evolve or transform over time. And perhaps you will become transformed a little too by living with the experience. The sentence in Cogitation says, quote, the core of the dream is not the manifest content, but the emotional experience. But when I say we don't know what the emotional experience is, I mean it could mean many things. And we know this because dreams are so condensed. They're packed together in very tight nuggets. That's why Jung wanted to flesh them out, expand them, amplify the dream, to try to walk around them and see them from so many different points of view. Gestalt therapy also did the same thing. Gestalt therapy asked us to take a dream and believe as if each character, each image in the dream were part of us, and speak to that, or have a conversation with it. So there's an emotional experience, but it's one we're not sure about. It's an unknown emotional experience. An unknown experience that challenges us, or intrigues us, haunts us, or invites us. The Talmud says every dream is an unopened letter from God. We don't open, or unable to open, too many of these letters. But sometimes a letter haunts us. So in this chapter, Eigen starts by saying that dreams try to represent what hurts. He says our dreams try to wrap around what hurts, but the womb keeps breaking apart. And as is characteristic, Eigen likes to dive right in with the tough stuff, the dark underbelly, that which is most difficult. And I've come to feel that this predilection of his for investigating the negative comes out of his own ongoing work with his own traumatized sensitivities. Now, dreams don't always signify trauma, but repetitive ones often do, if only to say the message needs repeating or hasn't gotten through, or worse, the damage is so great that trauma is having a hard time representing itself, let alone digesting what might be wrong. So in good double-sided fashion, Eigen tells us that dreams both contain and free. They anchor, yet hold possibilities of undiscovered meaning. Bad dreams or nightmares keep puncturing the womb or container, signaling damage. But all dreams do many things at once. They both reveal and conceal. They embrace something, yet run away. They take in or ingest the dream feelings and images, but also back away through evacuation. Hopefully, they help digest emotional experience while we sleep. I'm remembering that old commercial back from the 60s or 70s. It was hyped up. It said, you know, grow physical muscles while you sleep. You know, take this pill. Well, maybe this is the psyche's equivalent. If dream work is working well enough, we're growing our dreaming muscles while we sleep, and it helps us while we're awake. Now, Freud seemed most interested in what dreams conceal, wanting to get to the latent dream underneath the narrative of the manifest content. Jung and Bion seem more interested in what dreams reveal as living elements, containers for unknown beta elements in Bion, and images or symbols for Jung that have yet to be fleshed out and assimilated. Even when our dreams reveal something with precision, concealment is never far away. We see this with Jackie's dream in the chapter, where her simple dream uses so many maneuvers, splitting, reversal, fusion, idealization, that need deciphering, working and reworking for fullest contact and acknowledgement of what the dream was trying to say about her old boyfriend Mark and her current therapist. As a cocoon for wounds and wounding, dreams provide an arena for transformative work in the depths of our wounds. But there are different kinds of containers. Some are more rigid, dead, airtight, like fossils. Some containers seal up radioactive waste as long as possible, and other containers have a more permeable membrane for creative passage and commingling of material. Creative passage and commingling of material, permeability. This is a theme I want to take up this morning because it touches on areas of rhythm, flow, permeability, crucial elements that we can apply to all kinds of things. Containers, our relationships, conscious-unconscious exchange. But before we start dancing to rhythms and flow, I want to start to look with first an older model, or what I think of as an older model. I don't want to denigrate it because it has value. What I might call a vertical or a hierarchical model. Remember how Freud started out? Where id was, there ego shall be. Right? Okay, well, let's try it. No, don't. Don't try this at home. Okay, so what he's saying is something like this. He wants to go from id up to ego, so to speak. He wants to transmute. Or we could say it in a different way. We could say making the unconscious conscious. Right? That was another way to do it. So we'll put unconscious down here on the board, and we want to get to the goal of consciousness. Well, we could extend this. We could say the same thing about primary and secondary process. Primary process originally was said to be about discharge and chaotic and disorganized, and it was up to secondary process to deal with it and order it and prevent it and be a container, prevent primary process from too much discharge. We could keep going. We could say, let's go from pre-Oedipal to Oedipal. Or as Duane was pointing out last time, we could go from the paranoid schizoid position of Klein to the depressive position in advance. So then there were the battle cries, you know, in Freud's time. You have to make the Oedipal, achieve the Oedipal position. Or for Klein, you have to make the depressive position, achieve depressive position, as a kind of a sign of further development or maturity, psychological maturity. Well, I want to contrast this vertical hierarchical model with something different. And Duane was alluding to this last time too. Some people call this, somewhere Eigen says this is kind of a conquistador model of Freud's. Or we could say it's a control model. And I want to contrast it with something different. And actually, I believe it or not, I have a handout today. Yeah. Yay, handout. Let me pass those around there. And it's a contrast with what we might call a lateral or a more horizontal model. It's just one page. There's two sides, but there's just one page. And in the top of the page, there's more. In the top of the page, there's what I put on the board. One more. There you go. Sorry. Everybody got one? Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. Top of the page is what I started to put on the board, but I didn't have enough room. The vertical hierarchical model, so-called. That's just something I made up. And then underneath it, we have this lateral or horizontal model, which I would characterize as different capacities partnering with one another. Different capacities partnering with one another at their best. So when Duane was trying to use the double arrow that goes back and forth, that's flow. That's permeability. That's rhythm. That's fluidity. That's partnering. And we could even, so then I put them in a different order, but then I put the double arrow between them just as an imagistic representation of what I'm talking about. But we could do the same thing with concrete and abstract, or image and idea.
Go ahead. Horizontal model is dialectical.
So there's another word, dialectical. He uses it once in this chapter. He has it in quotes. It, as you know, Ron, it goes all the way back to Plato. And originally it had to do with dialogue, right? Another kind of flow and rhythm. I'm glad you bring that up. You know, Plato through Kant and Hegel, and now, is it Jessica Benjamin or Adrian Harris sort of brought it back to life? I can't remember. I get people confused. But dialectical, yeah, it's a fancy word for what we're talking about. Or maybe not so fancy. It's old. It's a back and forth. So don't look at the other side yet. It'll confuse you. And of course, as I say that, everybody will. That's okay too. That's okay. I can't stop it. I can't stop the flow. The paper's permeable too. Anyway, my point, or one of my points in talking about permeability and flow between domains, gets back to what we touched on last time. You know, why did Eigen take this word symbiosis that Bion uses, and change it to creative? Well, it started me thinking about creativity and symbiosis. Because the word symbiosis, we know, it indicates mutually beneficial exchange. It's a way of two things feeding each other. Like plants and trees give off oxygen as a byproduct, which benefits us, and we give off carbon dioxide as our byproduct that benefits plants and trees with photosynthesis. If the carbon dioxide doesn't get too excessive, which we know it is. So there's a symbiosis. So to me it seems like Eigen might be saying that in a way, with this lateral model, all symbiotic relationships express an aspect of creativity, creative growth, not just equilibrium, like the notion of eros, not just erotic, but creating greater unities, greater complexities. That's why I think of Eigen as erotic. So there's creative growth in symbiosis, even though we think of it as a kind of a regulated equilibrium. No, something new can come. Because when these capacities start partnering with each other, watch out. Instead of dominating one another. So it's okay to regress into the paranoid schizoid position and fall apart. Because we can come back and be a whole person again. But Bion is saying, and Eigen is saying something very funny. They're saying that to get to the really real, we have to first dream it, or at least allow DreamWork Alpha to work on it. And whether we know it or not, it's happening right now. Right here, right now. So instead of making it to the Oedipal, making it to the depressive position, we have a different model, a flow and reversal model, where as Ron was getting at disintegration and reintegration, or there's so many people have said it so many good ways. They're all true. They're all good expressions for what we're getting at here. That's why there's not just one way to think of it or say it. But it's less vertical or hierarchical, and there's no judgment either as to higher or lower. There's no judgment. It's not like image is lower than idea, you know, unless you're Aristotle, where, you know, he wanted to climb up the ladder to get to rationality and the idea. No. Intuition can be just as powerful, just as strong, just as real. Sensation can be just as real, powerful, true. So there's no hierarchy anymore. That's what another thing I love. The back and forth, the dialectic that Ron brought up, whether across a psychic membrane or between people, can lead to more communication, mutual enhancement when it's working well. A lot of this chapter is about when it doesn't work well, when it's damaged. And to Ron's point again, at psychotic levels of organization or disorganization, the rigidity, the frozenness, deadness, as defense against ultimate fear of so many things, fear of contact, fear of emotional reality, fear of one's own psyche. If we project these kinds of psychotic fears, we could say Medusa, turn you to stone, or unnameable dread, or rageful God. So in some sense, this permeability, this fluidity, this back and forth rhythm is an indicator of health. And we know this is true in our bodies, our physical bodies. You know, if you're dancing to the rhythm. But there's all kinds of rhythms that go on in our body. And I'm not going to go back through them because I've mentioned them before. But this brings up this funny kind of doubleness again, because we have these physical material bodies and we have this immaterial, invisible psyche, our experiences, experiential reality. We cannot locate a thought the same way we can locate a gallbladder. On the left side column is what I like to call all the intangible, invisible, immeasurable, infinite things, like mind, psyche, spirit, experience, intuition, imagination. They're all invisible. They're also infinite. And we can't measure them. We can't palpate them. How do we know they're infinite? Because psyche can speak to us across thousands of years. Ron just mentioned how. Plato still speaks to us. Buddha still speaks to us. Psyche doesn't die. Our physical manifestations die. We know this. They are tangible and visible and measurable and finite. But psyche is not. It reminds me of the story of the horrible occasion of a book burning somewhere in Eastern Europe. They were burning all the books, big bonfire, the whole library of knowledge and culture up in flames. And one man was crying, he was weeping. And another came up to him and said, don't cry. He said, it's okay. Psyche never dies. These ideas live on. I wanna read you something to end with. Going back to that funny little parenthesis where Eigen's, how did it go? Let's see. Almost from the bottom up. Right, what's he talking about? Well, I'll give you two more little things to chew on. That everyday life is the past, dreaming is the present, and the dreamless void is the future. Waking life is the past. Dreaming is the present. And imageless void, dreamless void, emptiness is the future. We're talking about dreaming. And we're talking about the importance of dreaming from the bottom up. But where do dreams come from? I think that's one of the places I started, one of the questions. Who is the author? Was Jackie the author of her dream? Ron thinks there was creative intelligence, intentionality, that reversed the valence of the characters and surprised Jackie. But where does that come from? What is that? You know, as scientists, maybe we want to try to pin it down. I would prefer not to. I used to want to, but now I don't want to. Why? It's fine the way it is. It's precious if it's left alone. But what's the it? Let me read you this. What shall we call it? We're now talking about what's underneath our dreams. The origin of dreaming. Where do they come from? What is it? I used a funny term like pregnant void. Eigen says this. If I can keep from crying. Shall we call this a wordless, imageless unconscious, a portal through which our lives are fed impalpably and ineffably by experiences that access us in dreamless sleep, deep dreamless sleep, as though God or nature or evolution has safeguarded something from our use of it. A special form of contact that we cannot ruin with our controlling narratives, our lust for power, or our fears. Something which gains access to us when our ordinary focus and selective attention, even that of our dreams, is out of play. A contact that accesses us when we are not looking. How can something touch us if we are not aware of it? This is something that marks our existence with a sense of mystery. It's a deep well that never ends, and we don't understand it. We don't know where it comes from. But as Arthur Eddington said, there's something unknown in the universe that's doing we know not what. So maybe that's where dreams come from. They come from infinity. There's so many words, labels, names we could use, but it's the feeling that touches me. The feeling that this, whatever it is real, it feeds us, it exists, and I think it deserves our respect. So thank you.